All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 type helicopter pilot in the Army. Anyway, welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. And so, as I mentioned before, we've got an upcoming event in Saline, Michigan. That's pretty exciting. I'll bring our people on to talk about that. Then we're going to be talking with author Don Bentley. And Don has written a new Matt Drake novel. And for those of you that read some of these stories, this is a continuation of the thing. And Don is going to be on in just a little bit to talk about his newest book, Forgotten War. And then in the third half of the program, as I used to say on Car Talk, we are going to have another guest on. Her name is Kathleen Anderson, and she writes for The Political Insider. We're going to talk about some of the problems with today's education and really what's going on with teaching history and civics. It's kind of like a lost art in our world today. So I want you to stick around, and I think you'll get to learn something new today. That's what's important. That's what we do here at Veterans Radio. I want to make sure before we get into it that we thank our loyal sponsors. We can't do this program without them. We can't do it without your support either. Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans specializes in veterans' disability claims. You can give them a call at 800-693-4800, or you can go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of a veteran-owned business. For more information, go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. If you want to do business with the federal government and you are a veteran-owned business, these are the guys you got to give a call to. National Veterans Development Council, 888-237-8433. Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information, you can go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. We also want to make sure that we thank our local veterans organizations. This is the Irwin Prescorn American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. They've been there since the very beginning. I don't know if you folks out there are familiar with Veterans Radio that much, but we've been on the air now for almost 20 years, and we're coming up on our 1,000th program on July the 9th. So mark your calendar now there, July the 9th, 1,000 programs for Veterans Radio. Pretty good accomplishment. I want to make sure that I thank Bob Gould, Ken Rogge, and Gary Lilly, who were there at the very beginning. And now we've got Jim Falsone as a host and a whole bunch of other contributors. And if you've got a story idea, by the way, that you'd like us to cover, please contact me. That's dale@veteransradio.net, and we'll get back to you. So there you go. All right, joining me right now are two veterans. One is Navy, one is Army. We won't hold it against either one of them. So we've got Don Gribb and Bob Schrock, and they are putting on an event in Saline. So, Don, I'm going to go to you first. So what's going on the 27th?
Yeah, it's May 27th at 11 a.m. at Christ our King in Saline at 3255 Waterworks Road. This is our third annual memorial event. This year we have a special speaker who many of you are familiar with, Paul Schwimmer, who actually is on a MIA recovery program in the South Pacific as we speak. So he will be returning before next Saturday. And we have a lot of events going along connected with this. And my partner here will give you a lot of those details.
Okay, Bob. So tell me what Paul, in addition to Paul Schwimmer, for our audience, Don just talked about it briefly. I don't know if the organization still has the same name of Bent Prop or not. But
it's History Flight now.
History Flight. Okay. Well, what History Flight does is Paul has been doing this for years, and that they go off to the South Pacific. They have found many aircraft out there, and they bring the remains home. Actually, they bring them through Hawaii, where they get identified, and then they bring them home. So it's a great program. He's a great speaker too. He's got a cool story. So Bob, tell us what else is going on there.
Well, we've got the Village Brass Quintet, the Bronner Brothers, the praise team, which is from our own church, and Deanna Newberry. We'll also have a gun salute taking place where we can't get the honor guard anymore. Veterans remembrance from the church, echo taps, and we got some military vehicles. I have a 1942 Ford Jeep and a 1943 Ford Jeep. The gun Jeep has a 50 caliber machine gun on it. We'll fire that.
Oh, yes.
We have quilts. We call them the quilt ladies. They're donating two quilts to be on the raffle free of charge. There's no charge on the raffle. And the ladies have been doing this for 25 some years. They have made over 5,000 quilts for the area.
Wow.
Mrs. Goins, who just retired, had made or worked on 3,999 quilts she had worked on. She couldn't make that number one to make it 5,000 or 4,000.
Exactly. We also have a free lunch, barbecue, pork, and some hamburgers or hot dogs and brats. It's, the whole event is free. There's no charge for anything.
Okay. Could you remind our audience when and where?
Yes. Saturday, May 27th, 11 a.m. at Christ Our King Church in Saline. That's 3255 Waterworks Road.
Okay. So, hey, I'm hoping might be able to get out there myself. I'd love to see that 50 caliber on a Jeep. That'd be pretty kind of cool. I want to thank you, both of you. That is Don Webb.
Are you getting up for like a page can't load or site not found?
On a, just forgot, wanted to thank, Don and Bob for being here and to make sure that we remember that it's a nice Patriot dinner there going on Saturday, May 27th. We will post more information about that on our website. Thank you both very much for being on Veterans Radio.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, we'll see you there, Dale.
That's pretty cool, I think, don't you? I am excited to talk to people about their different events. So if you have something coming up in the near future and you'd like to get a little promotion out of it, especially to the Southeast Michigan area, let us know. We'd be happy to promote it for you. Okay. So we're going to go right into our next guest. I received this book and I had a couple of weeks ago, and I got to tell you, you can't see it because we're not on TV. This is a big book, but it's a great story. And the author is Don Bentley, and Don has written Matt Drake. Some of you I mentioned earlier on, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Matt Drake bunch of stories, but this is the newest one, and it's really exciting. It talks about I'm going to find out how much is fiction and how much is nonfiction. The evacuation in Afghanistan. It's a really, it's an exciting story, and it's going to have you on the edge of your seat because you really become entwined with these characters that he has written about. So anyhow, I'm digressing here a little bit. So I want to welcome Don Bentley to Veterans Radio. Hi, Don.
Hey, Dale. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. So let's give our audience a little background, your military background, because it's an upgrade from mine, but I can see you have a nice model there that matches mine. So what was your experience in the military?
Yeah, so I spent 10 years as a Apache helicopter pilot, in, including a tour to Afghanistan from 2005 to 2006 as an air cavalry troop commander. And so I'm guessing that you flew Hueys, and it's kind of funny. I tell this story quite a bit that most of our instructor pilots in flight school were retired warrant officers or commissioned officers from Vietnam. And they used to tell stories about flying the Huey and it being underpowered, and they had to choose between more gas or more bullets because they didn't have enough power to choose both. And we always attributed it to just the musings of old aviators, until, no kidding, there I was in Afghanistan trying to figure out, do I take more bullets or more gas? Cause I don't have enough power for both. So it's kind of funny, maybe an upgrade, but probably a lot of the same problems you had.
It sounds like it. It's, yeah, we did argue about gas or bullets. And sometimes, well, I was a slick pilot, so I carried troops. And so we always had to decide whether we're going to more gas or more people take, you know, get them out.
Yeah.
And so forth. But so in addition to your being in the service, you had some other things, but how did you get involved in writing these stories?
Yeah. So I was always a storyteller. I remember being, a little kid, and I grew up in the 80s, and so they had this fine piece of cinematic television every Tuesday night called The A-Team, and it was amazing, but by about the third episode, you knew exactly what was going to happen and when it was going to happen, and I remember even then thinking, you know, wouldn't it be a better story if they would have done this or that, and so it took a while, you know, even as a kid mowing the grass and stuff like that, I'd be telling myself stories while I was doing it. And it took a while for my writing chops, my ability to form sentences and words and such to reach, the level that to be able to tell the stories I wanted to tell. But I had some great encouragement along the way. My senior year in high school, I had a fantastic English teacher who took me aside at one point and said, you know, you could actually do this. You have what it takes to be a writer. And so I took her advice to heart and went to college and majored in electrical engineering, as all good writers do. So it took me a while. I wrote three books over 17 years that never saw the light of day because they weren't quite good enough yet to sell. And actually wrote two of those books while I was still in the Army, when I was in Afghanistan after we'd fly a mission and most people would come back and play video games or do whatever. I'd work on the book I was writing on. And so took me a while to get there, and then I was fortunate enough when my debut novel, Without Sanction, sold in a two-book deal, and then that led the opportunity to write both my series and the Tom Clancy series, and now in 2024, I also get to take over the Vince Flynn, Mitch Rapp series, so I'm very, very fortunate.
Oh, yeah, you're going to be busy.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, it's for about the last I have the same editor. So my fourth book in my Matt Drake series that you were talking about, Forgotten War, came out just a couple of weeks ago. And then I also write in the Clancy universe, and I have the third book in the Clancy universe that I've written called Flashpoint that actually comes out on Tuesday. And then I have my fourth one called Weapons Grade, which comes out in September. So this year I'll actually have three books to come out. And the way that happened is every 5 months I would turn in a book, either one of the Matt Drake books or one of the Clancy books. So it's been a busy couple of years for sure.
I would say, I mean, I have nothing but admiration for writers. I don't know how, I'm lucky if I can sit down and write three sentences and go off of some, you know, think of something else to do. But I did really enjoy this book, and I'm a big Matt Drake fan now.
And I appreciate you saying that.
So tell us a little bit about, we don't want to give away the whole story, obviously, but tell us a little bit about The Forgotten War.
Sure. So I'll start by saying it's the fourth book in my series, but each one can be read as a standalone. So you can jump in with Forgotten War and join the gang there, and you won't feel left behind by any stretch. And so Matt Drake is a case officer for the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is just a fancy way of saying that he is a spy. And his job was very similar to the one that I did when I was an FBI special agent after I got out of the Army for a couple of years. And that my job was to run and recruit what in the criminal community we call sources and what in the intelligence community we call assets. And so when I was sitting down to write my first book with Matt Drake, which became Without Sanction, there were a couple things that kind of led that together. And so the first being, I wanted to write a case officer for the Defense Intelligence Agency, because when I looked out at what people doing, there were a lot of special forces guys running around. There were a lot of CIA assassins, but I hadn't seen anybody from the Defense Intelligence Agency. And it's a really interesting organization, much the same as the CIA from a mission set, but it reports through the military chain of command. And so there's lots of conflict built in there. And so, Matt is a case officer for the Defense Intelligence Agency. He's also a former Army Ranger, because two of my closest friends are from the Ranger Regiment. And for the last 10 years, I've worked for a series of companies that develop technology for customers in Special Operations Command. And so while I am not Matt Drake, I actually had an interviewer ask me that once. I've stood in the same room with men who could be, and they very much influence that character, Matt Drake. And so when Forgotten War, the fourth book in the series, takes place, what happens is that Matt and his best friend, who's a former Delta Force assaulter called Frodo, or he goes by his radio call sign of Frodo, are in a bar, and that's the beginning of all good books. I feel like they should all begin in a bar. And so it begins in a bar, and two Army CID agents come in to arrest Frodo, and they're arresting him for a crime that allegedly took place in Afghanistan 10 years prior. And so that was the first operational assignment. So Frodo was detailed from Delta Force to be kind of Matt's bodyguard while Matt was working as a case officer. And Afghanistan was their first tour duty together. And so when Matt realizes that, he realizes that the crime that happened took place as they were hitting a Taliban compound, and that and the two of them were augmenting a special forces ODA, or operational detachment alpha team. And so Matt tries to find the men who were in the room with Frodo 10 years ago when that crime took place, only to realize that each of those Green Berets has recently died under mysterious circumstances. So in order to figure out what really happened, Matt has to go back to Afghanistan and find the one man who was in the room with Frodo when the alleged crime took place, their Afghan interpreter. The only problem is that Matt is trying to go into Afghanistan in August of 2021 as everyone else is trying to leave. And so it is every bit a fictional story. It's designed to keep you turning pages way past what you want to, but as you kind of alluded to before, much of the book is based on actual events that happened, or versions of events that happened, or operations that happened that I kind of adjusted. But much of the book focuses on Afghan veterans of Afghanistan and their reaction to watching 20 years worth of blood and treasure and sacrifice just crumble before their eyes. And those conversations that form kind of the emotional core of the book are absolutely based on the conversations that I was having with fellow Afghan veterans as it was crumbling. And the texts and calls and emails I was receiving all came back over and over again to variations of one question. And that was it worth it? And I didn't know the answer to that. And so as a writer, I tried to find kind of the answer to that question in the pages of this book.
I think, I guess the thing that I was so interested in when I was reading this is, my war, on the way it didn't end well either for the American military. And not so bad for the military, but for the individual soldiers and sailors and Marines and so forth, is that, there wasn't any real explanation of why did we abandon these people? We promised that we were going to take care of them, and then we just walked away.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking as I was reading the book, what I thought was really interesting is that I have some contacts out there, not as many as you, but I talked to former Green Berets and so forth who were trying to figure out how to get back to Afghanistan and how could they help their interpreters get out.
Yep.
All these people that had been promised that they were going to be able to get out. And then one of the real plot lines here is that an organization is setting up this escape plan for, was it 500 Afghan civilians?
Yeah. And that's one of the crazy things. So again, I don't pretend that I speak for all Afghan veterans, but going back to the war first and kind of the outcome of it. So my son is, currently at officer candidate school for the Marine Corps. He's going to be commissioned as a second lieutenant, once he finishes college next year. And so he was born shortly after September 11th. And so as a veteran of Afghanistan and now a father of somebody who's going to be a service member, the thought that my son would have to go back to Afghanistan a generation later to do what I felt abhorred. That whole concept was just abhorrent to me. But at the same time, so I think many of us probably were ready for Afghanistan to end in one form or another. But I think we also believed we deserved a better ending than that, than watching the country crumble. And so one of the things that made Afghanistan unique was this notion of former veterans and sometimes not veterans at all, just civilians that said, you know what? There were Afghans who stood shoulder to shoulder with us because they believed that when the United States of America said, if you help me, we will protect you and your family. They took that promise at face value. And by God, we're going to honor it, even if our government won't. And so I think, you know, maybe not since Dunkirk and World War II has there been an example of a civilian populace that stood up and said, this isn't going to happen on our watch. And we will honor the promise that we made on behalf of our nation to these folks. And so between like the Pineapple Express and then a bunch of other, you know, unnamed organizations that carried out this incredible evacuation of Afghan interpreters and commandos and just folks that helped us because we said we would and it was the right thing. I knew that that had to play a prominent role in the novel too, because I was, you know, again, it was crazy as it was happening. I'm interested to hear if you had similar reactions when you watched The Fall of Saigon, is that on one hand, like I said, you're thinking to yourself, what in the world are we even still doing there? And then on the other hand, you're thinking, it can't end this way. Maybe I could still do something. At one point I was texting an old first sergeant who now works for an organization that was supplying the Afghan army or air force with helicopters. And I was texting him. I'm saying, do they still have helicopters there? And he's like, yeah, I know which hangar the rockets are located in. And so you're, you know, kind of half joking, checking flights to Kabul and saying, could I help? And then there were men and women who went beyond that and said, we are going to still help. We're going to go there on our own dollar. And it's just, you know, even though it was such a horrific thing that happened, there were these points of light or bits of hope that only in America, right? Only in America would people say, no, I'm going to buy a plane ticket on my own and go back to Afghanistan and honor the promise I made to these people. And so even through the horror of it all, there were still instances where you felt that pride of what it meant to be an American and what it meant to be an American who served in, during that 20-year conflict.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I have to admit, you know, when I was in Vietnam, I was kind of wondering, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
Type of thing. Because, you know, the military, the objectives were different. I mean, it just seemed like we were always continually taking the same place, giving it back, then going back out there and taking it again. And so forth. And, you know, and then you come home and it's still going on. And you kind of transition into your civilian life. And then suddenly it ends.
Yeah.
And it ends with these, you know, and the social media wasn't as obviously as big as it is now.
But yeah.
You end with that helicopter on top of a building.
Yeah.
People, you know, trying to, you know, climb over fences and walls and stuff just to get out. And you find, you know, in the area that we live in Ann Arbor, and I know you were out in Hillsdale a couple of weeks ago, you know, there's a lot of Vietnamese families here.
Mm-hmm.
And you listen to their stories, and they every time they find out that I'm a veteran or I'm with other veterans, they always come up and thank us.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, at least we had 10 years of freedom.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, and you've talked to some Afghan evacuees have probably said, you know, thank you. We had at least 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, without the Taliban and without all this other stuff that we'll never understand.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And I've had a lot of people, rightfully point out that Forgotten War, that title, normally applies to the Korean War as the, you know, between World War II and Vietnam, the Forgotten War. But I think from my perspective, while I wouldn't say the operational or the tactical or maybe even strategic strategy was as haphazard as it seemed to be in Vietnam, was that you still, you know, Rumsfeld was famous for saying something along the lines after the Iraq war kicked off that in Iraq, we do what we must. So in Afghanistan, we do what we can. And so after Iraq kicked off and just and things didn't go the way we expected it to be, it sucked all the energy out of the war on terror, all the strategy, all the, and so what you had was kind of Afghanistan, where we're continuously sending, you know, kids there to fight a war that seems to be going on based on entropy and nothing else, that we're just continuing to send men and women. And thank God that at least the last couple of years that Americans by and large stopped coming home in body bags. It certainly wasn't anywhere close to what it was in Vietnam, but it was still, you're scratching your head and thinking, you know, what are we doing here? What is the overall, what does winning even look like? And when you can't articulate that all anymore, and I think, you know, what's unique about the war on terror is that for 20 years, less than 0.25% of American sons and daughters shouldered that burden on behalf of their nation. Mm-hmm. 0.25%, and every single one of them were volunteers, and most of them volunteered for multiple tours of duty in Iraq or Afghanistan. And so where I think we, and I'm including myself because I got out in 2007, where I think we failed them as a nation is that once body bags stopped coming home, we as a nation lost focus on Afghanistan. We as a nation forgot about it. And so this tiny percentage continued to bear those burdens, where we as a nation stopped demanding accountability from our leaders to say, if you're going to send our sons and daughters into harm's way, by God, you better have a strategy to win that war and be done with it. And I think we as a nation forgot that. And that's why I kind of settled on the title of Forgotten War.
And it's obvious that you're very passionate about the subject.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm thinking that, you know, there are veterans from your generation, there are veterans from my generation that should read the book just because you have a good feeling.
Yeah.
You read it, and, you know, when, especially at when it's done, you have a good feeling. I'm not going to say everything that happened, but the point is that you can see that these men and women were, you know, from all over the civilian population, military, government, and everything else were finally, you know, coordinating their efforts.
Yeah.
You know, okay, how can I get these people out? Okay, we can squeeze one more in.
Yeah.
That was such an emotional part of the book that I got out of it was, you know, people were just going out of their way because so-and-so had helped so much but couldn't make the connection to get out. And the way that you described it, you know, as sort of an underground railroad organization, I just thought that was really cool.
Yeah, and there are a number of and so I to be clear, I didn't have any part of that, but I did a bunch of research on the Pineapple Express, and there's Tim Kennedy's book Scars and Stripes has a great section. It's his memoir, but about, he was one of the ones that went to Afghanistan and got people out. Chad Robichaud was another one. I believe his book is called Saving Aziz, where he talks about going back to get his interpreter. And so again, there were points of light in there. But it didn't end well, right? It still didn't have a happy ending. And what I tried to do and what I've been most thankful for the reviews, cause I think I got it right, or got what I set out to do, is the reviews that say something along the lines of, number one, thank you for not interjecting politics into this and throwing rocks at either administration or anything. That the reader would say, I felt like I got to see the war through the eyes of the men and women who fought it. And that what you did was, you know, you told me a really great story, because this is a book of fiction. What it's meant to do is tell a really great story, but I got to understand how the men and women saw this and why it affected them so profoundly. And then, you know, the second part of that being, people, a lot of folks say, you know, there's an emotional core to this book that I wouldn't have expected from a quote unquote military thriller. And I think for me, again, going back to, it's because while the characters are mostly false, some of them are based on real people, the sentiment they express is every bit as true as a nonfiction book, because I had, like I said, the slew of texts and phone calls and emails from other veterans who were all, and the thing about Afghanistan is it's foundational for, for the entire rest of the war on terror, right? And so what I saw, I'm the anomaly. I only served in Afghanistan from 2005 to 2006, and I only served one tour, but many of my friends served multiple times across Iraq and Afghanistan. And what I would hear them say is that if Afghanistan didn't matter, then did any of it matter? Did my service in Iraq matter? Did the sacrifices we made there? And so it was, you know, just heartbreaking to watch people trying to come to terms with that and understand something that they had, even though they had made sacrifices, even though they had lost friends, that if Afghanistan was still standing as a quasi, safe country, then maybe it was worth it. But when it wasn't anymore, it forced you to take a fresh look at all of that sacrifice, all of the blood and treasure, and then try to come to terms with what that meant. And so that's very much, you see the characters wrestling with that in the book, because my friends and I wrestled with the same thing.
Well, you know, you can see your generation of veterans are wrestling with this at 22 a day. And,
yeah.
You know, and this is something that we have to, you know, encourage your generation of veterans to talk about their experiences, you know,
yeah.
to reach out to their fellow veterans or professionals and to talk about these issues, because, you know, if you just bottle it up inside, you're going to
yeah.
by yourself, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, the motto is still the same, is that we had your back when we were in war. We
yeah.
got you back again today. And,
yeah.
you know, we want to help everybody, you know, live through this. I mean, you've already been through hell. So,
yeah.
Civilian life can't be that much worse. Well, probably in some cases it can, but not usually. So I encourage our audience to go out and read this. I'm talking with Don Bentley. The book is Forgotten War. It's a Matt Drake novel. I'm going to go back and read the other ones. I would really encourage you to get this. Is there any potential movie things going on here? I mean, this to me, I'm reading it going, oh, the camera should be here. And then
I appreciate that. That's every writer's dream. So not yet, but we're working on it. But I appreciate you saying that.
Well, you know, what's the other guy? Jack Reacher or what? Reacher or whatever.
Jack Reacher. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You
know, yeah.
Make a TV show about that.
He's doing well. And, my friend Mark Graney has The Gray Man. That was a movie. And then my other friend Jack Carr has his series on Amazon. So it is possible, but it's still really, really hard to get that to happen.
I'm sure that it is. But anyway, Don, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. Let me know when you've got another book and we'll bring you back on to talk about that one as well. Thank you very much for being on our program.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dale.
Okay. We're going to take a real quick break, and when we get back, we're going to be talking with Kathleen Anderson, better known as Kat, and we can talk about American education and what we can do to save the world, maybe. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Sergeant David Bleek, although a medical aid man, killed 3 North Korean soldiers and disarmed 2 more. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Bleek volunteered to accompany a reconnaissance patrol committed to engage the enemy and capture a prisoner for interrogation. Forging up the rugged slope of the key terrain, the group was subjected to intense automatic weapons and small arms fire and suffered several casualties. After administering to the wounded, Bleek continued to advance with the patrol. Nearing the crest of the hill while attempting to cross the fire-swept area to attend the wounded, he came under hostile fire from a small group of the enemy concealed in a trench. Entering the trench, he closed with the enemy, killed 2 with his bare hands, and a 3rd with his trench knife. Moving from the emplacement, Bleek saw a concussion grenade fall in front of a companion and, quickly shifting his position, shielded the man from the impact of the blast. Later, while ministering to the wounded, a hostile bullet struck him, but, despite the wound, Bleek undertook to evacuate the wounded comrade. As he moved down the hill with his heavy burden, two enemy soldiers with fixed bayonets attacked him. Closing with the aggressors, he grabbed them and smacked their heads together, then carried his helpless comrade down the hill to safety.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
This message is from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. If you were exposed to toxic substances in the military, a new law called the PACT Act may make you eligible for extra benefits and care. The PACT Act benefits veterans of the Vietnam, Gulf War, and post-9/11 eras. Learn more at va.gov/PACT or call 1-800-MY-VA-411.
Hey, we're back here on Veterans Radio, and my guest joining me right now is Kathleen Anderson. She writes for The Political Insider. She has a personal blog on Substack and is also a podcaster and has a military background. And we're going to be talking about sort of the lack of education for our next generation that's coming up. So, Kat, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me, Dale. I'm happy to be here again.
Well, it's awesome. I wanted to introduce you to our audience to let them know that there are lots of voices out there that are sticking up for them. And I want them to know that you are one of them and to tell our audience a little bit about your military background.
Yeah, definitely. So I retired about, it'll be 2 years ago this coming December from the United States Air Force. So I did a little over 20 years. I was enlisted. I made it to senior master sergeant. I joined basically as a baby right out of high school. I actually graduated high school early just so I could join the service as soon as I could. So I'd love to say it was because out of a sense of duty. I'm a pre-9/11 enlistee. So like a lot of people from my generation, I joined out of somewhat of a lack of options and because I wanted to do something other than just go into college. I didn't quite know what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I thought the service would be a good option. And it ended up being a great option. Did 20 years, like I said. I'm married. I met my husband while I was in the service. We were stationed in Greenland together when we met, which is pretty unique. A very tiny percentage of the Air Force ends up being stationed at Thule. And we got two little ones, a six-year-old and a four-year-old that we homeschool. And after I retired, I did a little bit of time doing some contractor work and had just kind of been working on my own personal blog. And I caught the eye of the Political Insider. And so now that's what I do full time is I write for them as their political commentator. And I cover all manner of beasts from the Pentagon to foreign policy, economics, and of course the education system, which is what I'm here to talk to you and your viewers about today.
Yeah, there is an article that I was sent that I got to read from our social media expert, Tammy, that was talking about American education. And so let me just quote a little bit from it before I make a mistake.
Oh, I hope it's a good quote.
Well, no, it just says only 13% of eighth graders are proficient in American history. And we're seeing a result of that. And I think that's, it's really sad when you look at that and you look at the numbers that were in your article. I teach at a local community college and I have to, whenever I tell a story, you know, because I'm 100 years old now, and whenever I tell a story, I have to fill in the blanks for them because they're not aware of Vietnam. They're not aware of Gettysburg. They're not aware of, you know, Jefferson, some of the other things that, that you think, well, gee, that's just normal. Everybody knows this stuff. But unfortunately, it seems that so many kids are not, you know, either being taught it or they're, you know, on their devices and, you know, adding to the confusion there because of everything that's on their devices. You know, I could put stuff up there and they don't check it sometimes. So you grew up in the article, you talk about growing up in Minnesota and having a history teacher that motivated you.
Yes, I did. So I went to what was considered one of the best public schools in the state. And you know, to be honest, you know, we look at the statistics that just recently came out for eighth graders today in 2023. And like you said, you know, 13% of eighth graders couldn't give you the historical context behind the Gettysburg Address. 22% of eighth graders couldn't tell you, you know, what the constitutional, you know, responsibilities of Congress are, you know, and that's very alarming. But the reality is that this downward trend when it comes to history and civics knowledge has been going on for 40 years, ever since I was in high school. And so, in fact, there was a paper written called A Nation at Risk 40 years ago that talked about how we've been kind of striving for mediocrity and how that we would be bit, you know, it would bite us later in the end. And that's kind of what we're seeing now. And so when I was in high school, you know, I could count on one hand how many teachers I had that were, you know, quality educators. I had a lot of teachers that would, I used to say they would teach from the VCR, where they just come in and put in a movie and turn the lights off. And then that was what you did for the day. There wasn't a whole lot of discussion or anything like that. But I was very lucky. My freshman history teacher, Mr. Perkins, was not one of those teachers. And so he was very engaged, you know, when it came to teaching, you know, American government and history and civics. And it really helped spark my personal passion for American government and for history, and really kind of set me on the path that I ended up going on. Even though, you know, I joined the service, I did end up getting my education and I got my master's degree in political management and bachelor's in political science. And, you know, I'm very passionate about civic duty and understanding why, you know, things are the way that they are and why the founding fathers did the things that they did. And it's very much thanks to that teacher.
Well, luckily most of us, well, I hope that most of us have had a teacher like that. You know, mine was Mr. Schneiser or Mr. Fox. You know, we would have these arguments in class and, you know, and we had the debates and so on and so forth. And I know that, you know, doesn't go on in a lot of classrooms now. And I don't want to, you know, paint the brush because I've run into a lot of history teachers. We do a lot of presentations in schools. For the local veterans organizations, and most of them are really good and they're really passionate about what they're trying to get their kids to understand. And you were talking about, how important the idea of civics is, you know, getting people to understand how our imperfect government works perfectly, which I thought was a great quote.
Thank you. Yeah. It's something that, you know, it's just not quite hitting, I don't think. And like I said, I think that started, you know, back in my generation 40 years ago, but it has just gotten significantly worse. And I think you see it, you know, with just everyday discourse, you know, and you don't have to be, you know, I'm a political commentator. So it's my job to be on Twitter and it's my job to watch the news, you know, an exorbitant amount of time during the day, but you don't have to be, you know, somebody like me to see that we're just having a really hard time having common sense, calm, healthy debate amongst one another. You know, there's study after study that talks about families that are being torn apart because of political differences and people feeling like they can't, you know, college professors and students feeling like they can't be open with, you know, their curriculum or with their debate. And if you like, to me, that blows my mind because college, you know, granted, I didn't have a typical college experience because I was in the service. But, you know, for me, college is where you're supposed to be challenged mentally and you're supposed to be, you know, exposed to so many different concepts and ideas and philosophies and debate them out. And that conflict can be a good thing. It can help lead to growth. But because I think, you know, in these formidable ages in eighth grade and high school and even younger, we're not putting an emphasis on civics. We're seeing what we're seeing now with, you know, what appears to be a massive polarization. And even without the, you know, it's hard to decide what's worse, the polarization or the apathy, right? You know, I had seen something the other day where, you know, 20 somethings were, you know, were polled and said that they'd rather give up the right to vote than give up TikTok on their phones. And maybe it's just because, you know, for 20 years I had to vote by absentee ballot that I'm like, I can't, You know, after I retired, I was so excited to vote in person. I made a whole day of it. I made sure, you know, at the time I was a salaried employee with the consulting firm. I took the whole day off as time off so I could go and do, you know, what arguably is one of the most important duties that we have as citizens, and one that, you know, is taken for granted. You know, Thomas Jefferson had said that, you know, that there's, we just live in a world where people don't understand what was fought for to get what you have in as simple as being able to go vote. And I've been all around this world. I went to Afghanistan numerous times and other, you know, locations that are just honestly not as great as this, you know, obviously imperfect country that we live in today. And a big reason why this country is so great is because you can go vote. So to think that that simple civic concept is lost on, you know, the young adults today. I mean, it's a pity to think where we're going to be in 20 years if it keeps that way.
Well, one of the things that I was thinking as you were mentioning that, we're talking with Kat Anderson here about American education and, you know, in a perfect world, what we would like to see happen. And I was thinking of, you know, one of the things that we had with my generation, now I'm starting to sound old again, but, you know, we had news shows. You know, we had Walter Cronkite. He would do the news, and that was it. And now we've got some news shows, but we have so many more people with their opinions. And, you know, and everybody's got an opinion. And some people are followed, you know, religiously for their opinions. And I think that sometimes we're getting away from the idea of balance in our lives. You know, everybody's got a bias. Every teacher has a bias. Every newscaster has a bias. And, you know, it either comes through a facial expression or a word that they might say. And I think that's something that we have to teach our children as well, is to be accepting of all those biases. I mean, we are a great country. There is no doubt about it. But we got a lot of warts, and we've had battles over this and battles over that, but we always seem to come through at the end with tentative agreements on things. And that's what we have to, I think, that we have to continue to maintain. The idea of cooperation, a little bit of empathy, and really trying to figure out what the other side is arguing about or what they're thinking, instead of just going, well, they're just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. You know, Mr. Perkins, he had all these great, very interactive lessons, and he would, he'd pick, you know, topics that were going on at the time in the news, and, or sometimes he would take, you know, past Supreme Court cases, and he'd have us, you know, we had to know kind of the basics of what was going on. And we'd all stand in the middle of the classroom, and he would, you know, say, okay, if you're for this, then you go on this side. If you're not, you go on this side. But you had gradients. You didn't go straight to the wall unless you were, you know, 100%. And so you can say, well, I'm going to take a few steps over to this side. And then he would add a new concept or a new point of interest that you wouldn't have known about, or, you know, a fact of the Supreme Court case. And he would say, okay, if you want to adjust, go ahead and adjust. And you'd see some students kind of move towards the other side. And the whole point of it, you know, every time he would talk about how, you know, just like with, you know, the world in general, just like with nations, people evolve in their thought processes, and people's views on issues come from numerous areas, whether it's your upbringing, whether it's personal experience, whether it's, you know, just kind of your own proclivities. But you can see how people will adjust, you know, and maybe, well, maybe I'm a little bit more, you know, right of center in this, or maybe I'm a little bit more left of center. And it was a valuable lesson because it taught that you didn't have to just, it's not like a camp structure, you know, you can be, have this particular opinion on a position, but be amenable to kind of adjust it as time goes on. Or even, you know, we'd have to do these debates in class, and he would talk about how the important thing is to understand why you feel the way you feel about something, mm-hmm. be able to articulate it in an intelligent and calm, organized manner, and then also be able to understand where the other person's coming from. But you don't have to agree with them, and you don't, the idea isn't to force them to agree with you. The idea is that you can communicate effectively to each other. And that's definitely, debate is a skill that many people don't have, to include many in Congress.
That's for sure. It's a little frightening to see that the, going back to Thomas Jefferson or the, one of those, you know, the whole thing, Benjamin Franklin said the same thing, you know, that we've got this, you know, this country, we've got to be careful or we're going to lose it. Mm-hmm. And Jefferson said, we got to be educated and, you know, we have to have an educated population. And I think, you know, you mentioned that, you know, you homeschool your kids and that's fine. There are some people that should homeschool their kids and there are some that should not. Mm-hmm. Just like school, you know, various schools are different and, I'm getting the signals that we're coming up toward the end of the hour. But I wanted to ask you real quick to kind of sum up what you think, what can we do to make the situation better? How can we save this generation?
Yeah, you know, and as a millennial, like I'm always, you know, cautious to judge generations because I'm, before Gen Z showed up, I was a part of the single most hated generation since I, the millennials. You know, so I think that there are definitely positives to what Gen Z and the generation coming after them, have to bring. But I think in terms of saving them and being able to save the love of history and civics, I think it's really on everybody. You know, I think people focus too much on like, well, the Department of Education needs to do this and this administration needs to do that and this school system needs to do this. But these things can't happen on their own in a vacuum. We all have a civic duty to make sure that we continue teaching the history, both the good, the bad, and the ugly of our own country and those that came before us. You know, learning about ancient history is important to understand where we got here, you know, understanding philosophy. Like we need to get back to a love of lifelong learning, whether it's students, parents, grandparents, teachers, administrators, whatever, we need to get back to really loving the idea of learning, because right now what we're doing is just not cutting it, you know, and we got to get back to kind of getting to the basics of reading again and understanding, you know, that things are imperfect, but it doesn't mean that it's still not the greatest country to live in. And being a citizen is hard work and it should be. So it's what makes it sweet. So, selling that I think is a good idea.
It is. I need to, I have to let you go. I do want you to come back and, we can continue the discussion or some of your other topics that you are writing about. We've been talking with Kat Anderson. You can find her everywhere, probably. but you can find her on Political Insider and also on Substack. And, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate having me on.
Okay. We'll be in touch. Okay. So another Veterans Radio program. Holy smokes, we're running up against the clock again. So write in your calendar, 1,000th program, July 9th. There's going to be an event. I haven't figured out what it's going to be yet. But we're going to go out on God Bless America today again, and we're going to be going out on a version of it by Christy Lane, who was a performer and entertainer in Vietnam at that time. So until next week, this is Dale Thronberry. For all of us here at Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above. From the mountains to the prairies, oceans white with foam. God bless us. night with a light from above, from the mountain.